This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. A pretty yellow buttercup is taking over this spring. We're talking about lesser celandine. The plant spends most of the year hidden, but springs up infesting southern Ohio this time of year. Today, we're going to ask our gardening experts how to manage this non-native. Plus, we'll talk about spring planting and, of course, take your phone calls. Joining me now are Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Imbus. Welcome back, Sarah.
Good to be here.
Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director and Home Meadow Song Farm Co-Overseer Peter Huttinger. Thanks for being here, Peter.
I'm looking forward to the show. Thank you.
And Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Entomology and Hamilton County Extension Educator Joe Boggs. Welcome back, Joe.
I'm glad to be on here.
We know you have questions and maybe some comments. Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. Now, one of our listeners emailed us earlier this month with a gardening question that was so good, we decided to start the show with it. Margarita sent this email. She writes, "My neighborhood and my front and backyard are infested with lesser celandine. It looks innocuous and even welcomed as a first spring flower, but it is taking over as a carpet that engulfs and suffocates any other ground cover. What to do aside from chemical treatment, and what is the least toxic way to treat?" Joe, what advice do you have for Margarita?
Well, if it's bad enough, we just say move, right? Right, Lucy? Just
get out the flamethrower. That won't even work, right?
It is, well, first, there's no magical answer to this. Lesser celandine is, it's what I call now you see it, now you don't weed. It's called a spring ephemeral. And what that means is that the vast majority of the season, of the year, actually, including winter, It's hiding below ground, and it's hiding in the form of these potato-like structures called tubers. And of course, they serve just like the same function as potatoes. They store energy that then in the spring supports the top growth. And of course, you know, once we get the top growth, which people are seeing these very dark, shiny green leaves, a sea of green leaves, which, of course, through photosynthesis, you know, develops more carbohydrates and the energy flow reverses to go down to feed these tubers. But the big showstopper are these buttercup flowers, and they are in the buttercup family. So that's why they were imported to begin with. Lesser celandine was brought to the country. It's a native of Europe. It's a very wide range, Europe, Asia, North Africa, even up into Siberia. Now, that should really, though, give us a clue as to how difficult this plant is to manage, because it's able to withstand a wide range of environmental conditions. And again, primarily because it doesn't have to deal with the heat of summer, for example. It doesn't have to deal with drought. It just rests, you know, below ground, like I said, as these tubers. But this brings about a real difficult challenge with management. You know, first of all, you may go online and read, well, you can dig these up. I've tried that, and I've watched others try it. And even if it's a very small patch, in one of our local parks, for example, we tried to dig up a patch that was honestly no bigger than about like a shovel, you know, like a shovel spade size, not very big. And we thought we got all the tubers, but you leave one tuber or even a piece of it, apparently, and plants will respring. So when you try to dig it up, it just basically becomes a game of whack-a-mole, because it just, you know, you leave these tubers and it keeps popping up, which then leaves really the only option that's realistic is to use an herbicide that does translocate to affect the tubers. And it's kind of a good news, bad news, and that is the good news is that if lesser celandine is in the in turf grass, which it doesn't do well in turf grass, it doesn't compete well, but it can creep out into lawns. And all the different herbicides that are labeled for use on lawns basically will take it out. It's not hard to control in that scenario. If it's in a wooded area, though, or in your landscape, that's a different matter, because a number of the compounds that we use in turf grass, you don't want to apply around trees or shrubs. And so we're typically left with something like glyphosate. The other downside is, despite this being such a widespread problem, not just in Southwest Ohio, but in the United States, I mean, you know, as a result of posting the Buckeye Yard and Garden line, which, by the way, if folks want to read more about it, all you need to do is just Google BYGL, Buckeye Yard and Garden line, and if you scroll down, you'll see the posting, which has all the pictures. Unfortunately, with this being so widespread, I'm only aware of one non-biased research-based study to try to take out lesser celandine. That was actually in Virginia in a preserve where, of course, the other point that was made is these will outcompete other spring ephemerals, which many of us call, of course, our wildflowers in the spring. Mm-hmm. So they timed it for when blooms were occurring. It took them 2 years. So an application 1 year, an application the next year, to achieve about 90 to 95% control. That's not 100%, is it? Mm-mm. So some being left behind, you know, means that, well, you have to keep after that. And you have to keep after it. Now, some of the herbicides, like the herbicides that are based on soaps or derivative of soaps, one called pellagoric acid, the trade name is Scythe, spelled just a bit like a scythe, like you're cutting something down. It's a top burner, meaning that it doesn't kill the tubers, but you would have to have started that earlier in the spring to try to avoid the carbohydrates being developed to feed those tubers, to get those things to grow, to be able to support plant growth. So it's a bit late for that, but unfortunately I cannot give you a non-chemical approach. This is just one of those that if you're going to take it out, you're going to have to focus on an application and read and follow that. You know, I know Sarah will jump in. Read and follow those label directions very closely. Make sure that you are doing everything on that label. And that's not just to keep yourself safe, but it's also so that you have a better chance of maximizing the efficacy. We don't want people to apply herbicides in a manner that they don't work because the application was bad, because now you're just exposing, you know, the environment to more to another pesticide. So we want you to be able to use it properly to get the maximum effect, but that's the unfortunate nature for this situation.
We're talking about gardening for the full hour today. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk at wvxu.org. Sarah, controversial question here. Should we all be trying to get rid of our lesser celandine? Is it any good for anything?
Before I answer that, I just want to give a shout out to one of our beautiful wildflowers that will be blooming now is the winter aconite, which sometimes people find it to be a little challenging to differentiate. So if you, before trying to control, please reach out to someone who might have better resources and educate you on that. I know Spring Grove Cemetery, for example, has a lovely display of the aconite that are blooming. Again, beautiful foliage and that lovely yellow buttercup flower, which they are actually relatives, but one is the lesser celandine, as we've mentioned, is invasive and can destroy or overpopulate and ruin a habitat, right? So the question, Lucy, is, yeah, if we don't do anything about this, what does that mean? So I'm not too educated as far as strictly on lesser celandine yet, because unfortunately, this is, I would say, a newer-ish invasive in this area. But similarly to other invasives, like the lovely Bradford pears that are blooming now, the Japanese honeysuckle, you know, the tree of heaven, all these other invasives that in different methods of how they got here and why they got here. But over time, they scientists find out that, you know, like honeysuckle, for example, has a natural toxin in its vascular system, in its root system, that will kill or prevent any other flora from flourishing. So I might have to defer to Joe or Peter, but to my knowledge, it's just really right now what I know about it is hardiness of its tuberous root structure, as well as its easily transportation and can really outcompete any of our other natives in our forest. And, you know, as far as transportation, I actually had a phone call yesterday, and I, without her even describing it, I said, you know, deer activity, their movement, their is really the primary way that it is moving from area to area. And she goes, oh my goodness, you're absolutely right. You know, they come up to my bird feeder that I have in the back of the house, and they come up through the woods. And I said, yeah. And then those little tubers get stuck in there, and their hooves, and that is an easy way, especially in these damp springs, you know, the soil is fairly moist, and things there can be relatively easy to lift out and then get stuck on their hooves and then be transplanted in various other ways. So, you know, similar to honeysuckle, it leaps out sooner, you know, it prevents any of our native wildflowers, early spring wildflowers, from germinating because it's not able to get, you know, that sunlight. So that's the little that I know about it thus far. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as far as it's, you know, I don't know too much more about, you know, if we leave it alone, what is it going to happen, except for the fact that it's going to overtake, similar to a lot of our other wild invasives that we have planted in our landscapes.
Well, what do you think, Joe? I mean, I've read that it can be good for erosion control. Or is there any help the lesser celandine can give us?
Well, you know, that's interesting. And Sarah brought up a couple of things for the connection to deer. That's not just from the tubers. They also have another secret weapon. They produce these little football-like structures. If you look down the axils of the plant, the deer pick up under their dew claws. So there's a very direct connection. The other thing, though, that kind of prevents it being really a long-term benefit in erosion control is in a very short period of time, and usually it's sometime in May to June, the above ground portion of the plant just completely disappears. Again, if you go to the big old alert that I posted, I have a picture of it. The plant collapses. In the picture, you can actually see these bulbs, you know, that are laying on the ground. And that will fool people. I mean, I've had homeowners, you know, who did use an herbicide, and they say, oh, you know, I sprayed it and it disappeared. Well, it just died of natural causes. The top just disappeared. So erosion control, I hate to say it, Lucy, but probably not, because it doesn't last that long. Mm. And that's a plus minus. You know, it does have a very, there's no doubt in my mind, and you can see it in my pictures. I have a whole series of pictures showing all kinds of our native spring ephemerals struggling to get through this massive growth. So there's no doubt in my mind there's a suppression there. But then it does disappear and then doesn't compete with later germinating things. That's what I said earlier about being good news, bad news, but being a spring ephemeral. And if we don't do anything, it's going to just simply become, you know, what we see in the background of things. I can't say take over the whole world. And one thing I do have to admit, even when I look at my pictures, this sea of buttercups, you can't help but you say, well, that's really kind of pretty. I mean, you can see why it was brought here as an ornamental. But dare I say it, I mean, you all might hang up on me, but, you know, even, let's face it, you're driving along, you look over at all these calorie pears, and you think, oh my gosh, that's terrible. But part of your brain says, oh, what a beautiful bloom, you know. So, I mean, it's even if as awful as it is. But yeah, we do need to be aware of the potential impact. I will say, though, that anyone listening that thinks they can tackle this and eliminate it, you know, from even a small area, it's a very difficult task to do. And if everybody in the neighborhood is not doing it, well, the deer will just keep reintroducing it, moving it around.
We do have some callers on the line, so let's start getting to those. Hey, Charlie, thanks for calling. What's your question?
Hi, I'm calling to ask, when is a good time to fertilize my knockout roses, and can you recommend a certain fertilizer?
Okay, thanks, Charlie. Who wants to take that one? Sarah, you have any thoughts about that?
Sure. Yeah. So, knockout roses, they typically don't need much fertilizer, especially once they're established. They bloom on new and old wood. They rarely need pruning unless you need to keep them in a certain type of, you know, size, restrict them in a certain part of your landscape. If you choose to fertilize them, if you're using a slow release, which means like a small pelleticized that will over time release fertilizer into the landscape, it's activated by water. I would do that, you know, early May, early to mid May, right before the danger of frost. If you want to do a liquid fertilizer, which I say is like a quick fix, which a lot of times I will refer to that if you have some plants, for example, your roses that look chlorotic, that are showing that yellowing symptom, that is quickly absorbed through the foliage, whereas the slow release is taken up through the root system and throughout the plant itself. Now, a lot of our grandifloras, hybrid teas, all those other types of flowers, the floribundas, they do typically need to be fertilized probably 2 times a year. So actually my gardening task tomorrow is I'm going to be pruning back my roses. We don't have any knockouts here. And then I will also be laying a slow release systemic for pest control, in particular the rose midge, which also helps with the rose sawfly, which have been very problematic in our landscape. So we will then fertilize those with a slow release organic, a fish emulsion. It does smell, but it is a great slow release. In particular, phosphorus and potassium for that flower and foliage development. We do have publications on that. But again, most of the times for the knockouts, fertilizer is not necessary. So I hope that helps.
Hope that helps, Charlie. Thanks so much for your call. We have another caller on the line. Before we go to that, I want to point out one of our callers, Donna, who didn't want to stay on the line. She says that winter aconite or aconite, I can't remember how you said it, Sarah, is not native to this area, but is native to Asia and Northern Europe. Is this one of those things that's not a native, but we don't dislike it as much as lesser celandine?
You know, if you go there, are, I mean, and I was going to mention this earlier, Sarah brought this up too, that I will have to say, as much as I'm like you, Sarah, I really like the winter aconite display there at Spring Grove. But if you go online and look at this, this is one that we just simply say, all right, let's keep our eyes on it. It doesn't appear to have the potential to go quite as wild as lesser celandine. However, there are some indications, maybe in colder climates. For example, Wisconsin's had a little bit of a challenge with this, with people saying, you know, this might have an invasive side. And I think that just brings up a point that we're not denigrating all non-natives. In fact, very few non-natives are invasive if you take a look across the board. But whenever we do introduce something that has some special gifts, if you will, this ability to, you know, intrude into ecosystems that it doesn't, you know, there's nothing else in that niche, then we get a little worried. We say, you know, well, we need to keep our eyes peeled for that. So I don't know if you agree with that, Sarah, or not, but it's just, I have a little concern with it.
Well, you know, Joe, it brings up something I think is kind of important for us to think about with anything what we consider invasive. I mean, also there are plants that are native to North America that because of climate change, as we get warmer, you know, they're going to be creeping further north. And so how do we deal with this, whether we want to go full tilt battle, you know, or do we, you know, kind of reassess what is native, what is local, and learn to, you know, work with it. And there was a book that was published a number of years ago called Beyond the War on Invasive Species by Teo Orion. And it's a really interesting approach. It's stems from the point of view of permaculture ideology, philosophy. And but it's about like, you know, we bring these things upon ourselves and, you know, maybe eradicating them and taking this sort of warlike mentality of destruction, you know, may not always be the solution. I mean, I don't like lesser selenite. It's very scary to me. It's very sad and it's taken over our property on Gray Road in spite of all kinds of stuff we've tried. But I do think it's just in a broader sense, I think we really need to kind of rethink you know, in many ways about, you know, the whole idea of invasive, you know, and, you know, how to deal with it.
Well, I like what you're saying, Peter, because sometimes, I mean, let's just face it, you know, there was no way to stop emerald ash borer. I mean, we can protect trees individually, but there was no way to stop it. A lot of these invasives, realistically, you have to step back and say, well, you know, there's no way. I mean, we can't take calorie pears, you know, off the playboard. You know, they're here. They're, you know, the same with the Asian honeysuckles. I mean, these. I hear what you're saying, Peter. That sometimes and I hope I didn't imply this. I hope I didn't imply that we should all run out, you know, and spray glyphosate willy nilly.
I know you didn't.
But maybe some of the listeners may have thought, well, he's just. I don't believe we are going to be able to stop lesser celandine. We might be able to focus certain areas. Let's say you have a park that you really have a beautiful, you know, display of some of the early spring ephemeral natives, and you want to protect them. I think there's a way to do that in that one location. But there's another side to this, too. Eventually, you know, a good example, and I use this all the time, Japanese beetles. I jokingly ask people, well, where did they come from? And of course, they were introduced, you know, back in the 30s or two different introductions and in the teens. And now you hardly see Japanese beetles in greater Cincinnati because nature has found a way. They're being regulated by natural forces. So this could always happen. I mean, if you go in the summer and look, and I'm going to make a statement here and I don't want to overstep, but if you go look in the summer at the Asian honeysuckles, they're subject to a very serious disease. You'll see the leaves browning and so on and so forth. Now, you got to be careful. It's only one type that's subject to that particular disease. But it's showing us that whenever you have a plant that's dominating an ecosystem, there may be other things that come along. And I think that's what that, I think if I remember, Peter, that's kind of a theme in that book is that, right. You know, sometimes things start equilibrating. And I think that's fascinating. And it's something we can always learn from.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes nature self-corrects. And also, you know, the allopathic properties of lesser celandine is kind of interesting that those qualities of plants that honeysuckle also has evidently, but, you know, in use of cover crops, you know, like winter rye, for instance, has an allopathic property that keeps weeds from germinating up within it. And so some of these things, you know, in some cases are working to our advantage.
Well, we are going to continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking about gardening for the full hour today, and we have experts ready to answer your questions. My guests are Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Imbus, Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director and Home Meadow Song Farm Co-Overseer Peter Huttinger, and Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Entomology and Hamilton County Extension Educator, Joe Boggs. They're here to share their knowledge. Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We have a caller who's been waiting so patiently. Hey, Jacob, thank you so much for your patience. What is your question or comment?
Hi, everybody. Thanks for doing this and answering the question. My question today is, I have tried to have a eatable garden that I plant with my kids in our backyard for the last 4 or 5 years. And last year was the first year I didn't do it and just gave up because it's always being attacked between chipmunks and squirrels and deer. And if they're not going eating what I have, they're going after, ruining kind of the garden. And so what can I plant that I can do with my kids that would help survive in this neighborhood and not get it attacked?
Well, the good news is you've planted a very tasty garden, Jacob. You're just not getting to eat it. Peter, what do you think? Do you have advice for Jacob?
Yeah. The problem is, well, it can be what you plant, but it can also be, what deterrents can you use? Because in some, like a deer, you can use fencing or wire lines to kind of keep them out. There's also different deterrents you can get in terms of like these scram materials that you spread on the ground. A lot of those are a little bit problematic because every time you get a heavy rain, you have to, reapply those. So I don't know if Sarah has any other kinds of things about that, but fencing is a good way. And some things like squirrels are really hard to control because they, can pretty much climb over anything. In terms of tomatoes, the one thing I've found is by planting cherry tomatoes, you have less of a problem with squirrels because they will go to the main tomatoes, larger tomatoes, and take one bite out of them and suck the liquid out of them because they basically want the fluid as much as the nutrients. And the cherry tomatoes, I've never been quite sure whether they just aren't interested in them or there's so many on the plant you don't notice if they run off with a couple. but that's a kind of a good solution there. But
do you have any other tips, Sarah?
I just say, if you're in the city compared to the county, I truly believe there's a difference of their mindset between county and city deer, city deer, urban deer. That's not the scientific, terminology for them, but I have talked with our wildlife specialist at the university, and it's one of those things you have to do different types of deterrence, fencing, sound, but rotate those. So just not, putting an owl up, for example, and keep it in the same place year after year after year is not going to work, right? Mm-hmm. So there's all different types of deterrence. By far, what works is fencing, and there's different types of, heights and materials that you can use, which I'm happy to go over that with you. We have, depending upon the city, there might be ordinances or, you kind of want to look nice. So, I've kind of worked with a few other things, definitely some deterrent odor, that is organic, that is labeled for vegetable production, can be used. I personally also use those, and they've worked well. You can find those at the box stores and out in the area. So yeah, just a few different tactics, I think, and it's not necessarily don't plant this or don't plant that. Certain plants, for example, like, lavender, for example, I've used that for a border. And yes, that has some shown that deer tend to not like to eat that, but that doesn't mean that they're going to avoid your overall vegetable garden forever.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that other mammals are going to avoid your, but with fencing, what I have found, yes, it might keep the deer away, but then you have to be smart. And so the rabbits and other mammals don't sneak up underneath it. So, so strategies with that. So sometimes I too, me personally, this gives a greater appreciation for farmers and where our food comes from. So for example, I've given up on growing tomatoes in my home garden because, yeah, wildlife takes it over. And I'm just like, you know what? Thank you, farmer. So they can do it. And, they might have other, means of preventing the deer activity. So then I'll grow other things that aren't as desirable, like some of my fruits aren't as desirable to wildlife. So I hope that helps, but there's not like one answer for everyone, and everyone's little landscape is, different as well. So I'm happy to have a side conversation or an email conversation with you if you need that.
That's tricky. You know, he's dealing with deer and chipmunks and squirrels. I mean, how do you keep all those away?
Right.
Yeah. You can use tenting. You know, at certain times of the year when we put in young plants, we put up what's called low tunnels. It's a low wire, and you put a product called Remay or floating row cover over them, over the plants. That can use that to protect them against insects, but also to kind of keep the birds off until the plants, they like lettuces, get big enough that they can withstand a little pressure from insects as opposed to being plucked out whole. Those are things you can kind of do. But, you know, nothing to think if you're really wanting to garden as a family and you have it becomes really problematic at home, I really suggest looking into the possibility of participating in a community garden. Oh. You know, Turner Farm, we have garden community gardens around the city, and then the Civic Garden Center of Greater Cincinnati. Their website has a nice comprehensive search engine to search out different gardens that might be closer to your specific neighborhood. So if you want to contact me through Lucy after the show about, you know, where our gardens are, feel free. And then there's, like I said, the Civic Garden Center website can direct you to some other places.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I wanted to say something, and it's just, and I'm glad, Peter, finally we got around to insects, which really are the most important animals, right? I mean, I think you'd agree, Lucy.
Oh, yeah.
But seriously, let's consider something a little different. Peter, it really goes back to, again, but I keep referring to that book. You know, flood the environment. If you're, I mean, Jacob, you're doing this with your kids, and that's wonderful. Accepting the idea that there's going to be a certain amount of losses. So starting there, but then that teaches a lesson. Learning about, as Sarah said, there's different behaviors between, you know, animals that have adapted to our urban environments compared to those that are out in the country. But on the other hand, you know, helping your children and learning together as to why they're doing that and how they're doing it. And when I say flood the environment, you know, put out a lot of different types of vegetables. You're going to lose some. You're going to have some that are going to have problems. But as Peter's pointed out, and this surprised me, I didn't know that the cherry tomatoes were a little less, you know, useful to squirrels. On the other hand, we have a ground squirrel, and he wouldn't eat them. We'd just find these little piles of cherry tomatoes here and there. Never quite figured out that behavior. But the point I'm making is that, you know, being able to put things out and not considered a loss regarding the loss of having a tomato, but a gain in knowledge that your children can learn about wildlife, you know, maybe look at it from that little different approach.
Yeah. Thanks for that call, Jacob. Great conversation. We do have more callers on the line. Let's go to David. Hey, David, thanks for your call. What's your question?
Hi, thanks. I'm sorry to bring you back to the distasteful subject of lesser kind. But anyway, it's invaded all my better beds. I wondered, and I just jumped into the show halfway through, but I wondered if any of your experts had experience with just removing as many of the valuable plants as possible, and then torching the area as a way of killing off all those filaments. Because if you try to pull it up, of course, you're going to lose most of your topsoil. So I just wondered if anybody had experience with that. I mean, I use the torch to, you know, for limited weed control on the edge of beds anyway.
Yeah. Thanks, David. See, I mentioned flamethrower when we first started
talking
about
this. Yeah, I was going to say, I thought Sarah was going to jump in on that. Isn't she a flamethrower?
It's one of my favorite tools.
I know. I kept waiting. Burning it down, again, you know, either as I mentioned earlier, the pellagoric acid, which is a type of, in the soap arena, that burns the tops down. It doesn't affect underground. The same, you know, with heat. That burns the top down. So if you started in March, quite frankly, when the plants first come up and stay at it, you might have a possibility of controlling it. On the other hand, I liked what you were, I thought you were getting at this and perhaps going to say this. There have been a few places where people have used black plastic and just sacrificed the bed for one season. So you start at the very beginning, you know, you start right now and you just say, well, okay, I'm not going to, it's in this flower bed. I have so many things I want to grow in there and I don't want it in there. So they'll lay the black plastic down And the heat, if you have it's in a sunny location, presumably the heat can help suppress those tubers. The downside, though, goes back, and I keep saying downsides on this because there's so many, and that is those tubers, you're waiting to exhaust them, and you're waiting for heat below ground to penetrate the soil. It may not work. There have been a few instances I'm aware of in some of the high profile, not here in Cincinnati, elsewhere, landscapes where they've been successful with the black plastic. But then 3-4 years later, now there's a park up in Columbus where it's coming back in. Hmm. So there are ways to suppress. I don't know if there's a way to totally eliminate.
Well, I hope that helps, David. I'm sorry. I really thought the flamethrower was something we were going to build upon today. Yeah.
Well, a note on flame weeding is that, you want to be careful when you do it. You don't want to do it when there's a lot of dry grass around. It will catch things on fire. Yeah. But we do use them quite a bit in our farms. Our community gardens are set up more like mini farms. So we do use it. And at this time of year in the spring, I would just want to mention is that after you clean your beds and you wait, 4 or 5 days, and all of a sudden you see a whole little bed, a lot of small weeds have germinated. That's an excellent time to go over that bed and kill those little weeds when they're just their little cotyledon leaves up, and to kill them back. And that'll usually take care of them. And then, wait a couple of days and direct sow in these beds or transplant into these beds. So it's the flame weeder is a very useful tool, but just always be mindful. Also, if it had rains, light rain, and the plants are still damp, you actually, when you flame them, then you kind of flame and steam them. So that's actually a good time to use the flame weeder, and also a safer time because there's less dry material where, things might spread on you.
Okay.
Man, I got hungrier when you said flame and steam them. This is you make a good point, Peter. Right now, we're really seeing a lot of what we call winter annuals coming up, and their seed germinates, at a different time than what we're used to. It germinates in the fall, but we see the plants up right now, and flaming those plants right now before they produce seed works really well for this wide range of weeds that we see in the spring called winter annuals. Usually by the time the summer annuals start happening, you've already planted, so you may not be able to do it, but I've been hearing that a lot, Peter, about people taking out winter annuals before they do anything, and it works very well with flaming.
Yeah. Well, we're going to continue with our gardening show in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're heading into the final stretch of our gardening show. Now's the time to ask your questions. You can call 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. My guests are Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Imbus, Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director and Home Meadow Song Farm Co-Overseer Peter Huttinger, and Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Entomology and Hamilton County Extension Educator Joe Boggs. We're going to have to probably do some lightning round answers to some, because we've got a caller who's been waiting on the line. We have some email questions, so let's start with our caller. Hi, Marianne. Thanks for your call. What's your question?
Hi, thank you. I just tuned in and heard the word invasive. My son bought a home with a beautiful perennial garden in the backyard, like three sides. That garden now is full of chameleon plant rhizomes. And we've been digging and digging, but last year it just took over. We've tried poison. We've tried covering it for a season. I've been digging down to the clay. The roots are that deep. And the soil above is beautiful. I'm ready to hire a garden a landscaper for $10,000 to try to get rid of this plant that is now growing into the grass.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, so you're wondering if they have any advice for you before you spend all that money.
Spend all that money. When it's a young couple with two small kids and they can't dig all day, I'm digging a foot, 2-3 feet at a time in 4 hours.
Yeah.
It's like somebody threw spaghetti underground.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Well, let's see. Do any of our experts on the panel have advice for Marianne? I don't know who wants to.
I'm kind of not recognizing the plant. Mm-hmm. Peter or Sarah?
Can there be a repeat of what it is? It might be a common name, which
Marianne, can you tell us again what the...
It's a Chinese plant. I've looked it up as chameleon, and it comes up. It's like a colored green and reddish and little cute little flowers that bloom, and it spreads by long rhizomes, very long, underground. And it's called a chameleon plant. I don't know the Chinese name for it or the proper name.
Does it have an odor to it?
Yes, it fish and mint. It's called a fish mint plant.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's quite a combo. Is anybody?
Well, I did find it. I'm really surprised. I actually have not seen that. I now see what it is, but I haven't seen that too often. And have you all? That's a surprise.
I'm not familiar with it.
Oh yes, I have seen this. There's a variegated variety.
Yes, yeah, I did the same thing, Sarah.
Yeah, so I have a personal, if my aunt's listening, which I don't know, I have this my dad's garden. I had just the green, not the variegated. And yes, it does quickly take over. I felt like it smelled horrible, like an animal had been in there, similar to boxwoods. I hate the smell of boxwoods. But then my aunt thinks, she goes, oh, well, I'll take them. She had an area that she, you know, anyways, and she said she thinks it smells like citrus. Well, we've had this ongoing battle for, I don't know, 20 years. And whenever I see this plant, I just get, I don't know, this like grotesque look on my face, because to me, it doesn't add much value to the landscape. I really don't know much about, I don't even know where it came from. I don't think... any reputable nursery that I tend to shop at, I don't see it. So it must be one of those, you know, I don't have much, but I would try to remove as much as possible. And then if need be, because it does last all summer long. It is very drought tolerant. There's very low maintenance. It doesn't spread as crazy from my last encounter of it. It doesn't spread as crazily as like the lesser celandine, of course, but I think it's just a foul specimen.
Okay. And no great ideas on how to kill it.
Just like any of our other techniques, you know, it's not as aggressive, again, in my experience. So, you know, you could... remove as much as possible the root structure, but again, because it does have a long, it's actually almost kind of like a semi-evergreen. I've seen this kind of stay, you know, viable. It doesn't turn woody, the stem doesn't turn woody, but it can kind of keep its foliage into, you know, when there's snow on the ground. So it is herbaceous. It does die back, but you could do some solarization. You could do some topical spray. With any weed control or plant control, if you're trying to get rid of it, the sooner you start seeing it, the younger that a plant is, the better control that you'll get, right? So if it's in full bloom in June, July, you're not going to get a great foliar application efficacy, right? So just be mindful of that with whatever kind of control you're trying to do in your landscape. But yeah, this is funny. I never knew... I didn't know it had a name.
Yeah, it threw me completely off. Yeah.
Well, we have some. We're running out of time. This has gone so fast. We had Richard, a caller on the line, that said he couldn't stay with us, but a winter annual is taking over the area called Hairy Bitter Cress. Can the experts share how to combat that? Anyone have a very quick idea on that?
Pull it or burn it.
Pull it or burn it.
Yeah, it's, I mean, these are winter annuals. They don't dedicate a lot of energy to the root system. And quite honestly, I have it around my house too. And pulling it up right now and getting rid of it before it produces seed, you can whittle it down year after year.
Okay. We have a caller, Reza, who asks, is planting an apple tree and would like to know what types of soil he should use. Any recommendations there?
Well, when you're planting fruit trees or really any tree, because we have heavy soils, if you follow the instructions to come with the tree, it's always important. But when we dig these holes to put them the root ball in, you're basically almost making a clay pot. So one of the things I like to do is to use a tool or the edge of a shovel to kind of break up the sides and crumble the clay, heavy soil that's around it. And then you don't want to just fill the hole up with store-bought soil or pure compost. You want to mix in some small amount of compost in with the soil that you dug out of the hole, and then plant the tree into that. Because if you don't, you just create a pot, and then the young tree can become root-bound because it'll just go out to a certain point, hit that hard kind of burner surface from the shovel, and just keep going around in a circle. So that's something to consider. Also, you should plant the tree a little high, because when the soil settles down, it'll drop down too. But you don't want it, if you do it perfectly at ground level, you'll have a tree that then sinks lower. And with most fruit trees you'll be buying or graft, you want to make sure that graft is above the ground. And that's something that's very important to do.
Okay. We have another caller on the line. Hi, Steve. Thanks for calling. What's your question? Very quickly.
I just wanted to figure out what I can do about getting rid of onion grass, whether that's actually what it's called or not, I don't know. And then I also have a big problem with mulch, and it's been going on for years and years.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. Any quick advice for Steve on onion grass and moles?
Well, onion grass or wild onions and wild garlic, very difficult to manage. Thankfully, they're kind of an early spring thing that sort of disappears. But if you really have a challenge, you can direct apply glyphosate to the surface of those. But roughening it up first, just take something to roughen up the surface of the leaves, the blade-like leaves, will help that. And of course, you're going to be wearing gloves and being careful. The other part of your question,
moles.
What was the other part of the question?
Moles.
Yeah. Trapping is your best approach. Purchase the traps, read and follow those label directions very, very closely. Moles tend to have one run that they use, like their main highway. Then they have feeding runs off of that. So you walk out in your yard and you just press down all of the soil, come out the next day, whichever one of those runs are up. I always recommend press it down again just to make sure that's not one of the feeding runs. And then the third day, if it's still up, that's the main highway, and that's where you will position the traps.
Okay.
Or the trap.
There you go. Okay. Thanks, Steve.
But I'd like to just...
I apologize. We are running out of time. I want to say that Sarah Imbas has great information about a grant program available for Campbell County residents. Please check out her website to get more information about that. Peter Huttinger, we were going to have a great conversation about what to plant this time of year. We totally ran out of time. So I suggest checking out Turner Farm Community Garden Program's website to get more information. I've been talking with Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Imbas, Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director and Home Meadow Song Farm Co-Overseer Peter Huttinger, and Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Entomology and Hamilton County Extension Educator Joe Boggs. Thank you all so much for your time today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WBXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.